Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2020. I've already lost count. I think it's the sixth night, maybe the fifth. Can't remember now. But anyway, this is we've got four streams coming up tonight, and I think I might have rescheduled the E. Michael Jones one for the 23rd, but I'm not sure yet. So I'll oh, and also Martin Lichtmes, Duke of Durham, and Redpill Germany have been jiggled about, so you might want to check the schedule to keep up to date with that. Now, as for tonight, there are four streams. Crypto for Nationalists is coming up in 2 hours, then Clossington, and then Apollonian Germ. But first, it's Garrod Murphy. But before I introduce him, I just want to do the T-shirt thing and tell you which one it is tonight. It's Robocop with the quote from Clarence Boddicker, state-of-the-art bang bang. Very stylish. All right, so, Garrod. Welcome back to Millennial. Oh, I think you've.
Howdy.
Hi.
No, I'm here. I was just sharing the link, actually. Thanks for having me. I just need to check out your t-shirt as well. I
It's
know you just did it for the
very,
audio.
very cool. Very cool. And
Very cool. Yeah.
amazing.
Very cool, Kanye. Yeah.
I'll just get the link as well and share it around. And then we'll get started. There it is. Excellent. There we go. All right. Okay, so let's get to it then. So this has been a hell of a year. You have done a sort of chronology of the year from your own perspective. So I think, well, first of all, why don't you briefly introduce yourself, just in case anyone doesn't remember you from last year, which I thought, by the way, last year's stream with Garrod was a really good one. It's one of my favorites of last year, so you should all go and check that out on BitChute. Okay, so Garrod, please introduce yourself.
Well, I will now, but in terms of the stream last year, I am worried that I made prognostications that were wrong, so I was actually afraid to listen back to it. I wouldn't listen back to it because I was like, no, I'm going to have really misdiagnosed 2020 in advance. But
Well, we probably all did.
yeah, so it's hard to describe. I don't know what I said about myself last year. Maybe I said journalist more because this time last year, that would have been more true. Maybe I've been doing less of that this year, kind of like proper journalism, not just like sharing stuff that's online and commenting on it the way we all kind of do. I was doing more than that, finding new information, which you would kind of call journalism. So I used that somewhat tongue in cheek as well, because I was trying to say like I'm a journalist too, to the journalists and kind of annoy them. But other than that, I have a YouTube channel and a Twitter, and I kind of use them both, and do my thing, nationalist, that type of thing. I don't know. I don't really have much more of a kind of business card than that, really. But that's just kind of what I do: nationalist journalism and commentary.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So let's get, I mean, that your links are below so people can find you easily. Let's get to the issue of 2020. What did you briefly, if you can recall, what did you pr anticipate this year being? If we can go back to December last year. Can you recall? I remember a lot of optimism about, the new decade that is about to start and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, that's the slightly cringe aspect of it, is that I don't think, maybe I didn't make massive prognostications, but I might have said like, now is our time to rise up, type of vibe. This is going to be our decade, whatever. And that's the thing. Decade is what I would have said, not year, which would make it even worse. So that's why I'm afraid to listen back. And I've learned my lesson, actually. Because millennial is kind of landmark. People, I kind of look back to those as a kind of like placeholder for years or end of year sentiment. So I won't be making diagnosis for the decade to come again. But what I thought, I think, was something like that. It's going to be a decade where the system starts to fall apart, where the contradiction between the system's own professed liberalism will rub up against its need to become authoritarian, which is arguably coming true. I don't know. Something along those lines. I can't remember exactly what I was predicting. I think it was generally just a hopeful kind of general buzz about the decade to come. That, so much happened between 2016 and 2020 in terms of populist uprising, and there's a whole conversation with Trump, and I've heard you talk to people about that a bit already, but that, you know, this next decade, kind of like the 20s of the 20th century, you could say, which led to the 30s, et cetera, perhaps.
Right. Yes, that was the, you know, that was a thing. People were saying the Roaring 20s, and you know, it could still it could still be like that. It could still turn out to be a decade where some people are lots of people are very poor. There are lots of people making lots of money. A big, you know, divide there, and a lot of uncertainty. That wouldn't surprise me at this point. Actually, especially because of cryptocurrency. I think there are probably going to be a lot of millionaires and even billionaires created by cryptocurrency who probably just from the ordinary public. That could happen as a sort of weird fluke. But at the same time, I think there are going to be lots of people impoverished. I think you've already seen it with the, well, so let's get to this year then, because that's really the crux of the matter, because obviously, you and other people, including me, in vague terms, predicted that this was going to be a decade of possibility and a lot of turbulence, great turbulence. And I still think that it's going to be a very turbulent decade. I am unsettled in a big way by this first chapter in it, because COVID and the lockdown and now the Great Reset, that has taken everyone by surprise. Nobody could have predicted that something like this was about to happen. I suspect that even the powers that be didn't predict that it was about, that it didn't know that it was around the corner. I think that they decided, well, that's another matter. Okay, so let's get to your chronology of 2020.
Well, there are so many, just note as well, there are so many rabbit holes. Like you had to prevent yourself from just jumping down that one. I've felt the urge about 7 times already. So it is hard because it has been such a dense, crazy year. Like it's hard not to just immediately go into a conversation about COVID-19. How can you not? But anyway, you know, we'll play around with it. Chronology wise, I kind of did that just for the audience in a way. The reason we're doing this is because I just took some notes and I was telling you about it in advance. I didn't expect this to be the framework. I was just trying to kind of have a rough, like scribbled, what happened this year, just in case he asks me. And seeming as we're going to go with it, we may as well. So the last time I talked to you was basically this time last year. And this is, of course, is an Irish context as well, because, you know, that's all I can offer the guests, really, or sorry, the viewers as well, is that's my unique insight into this country. Between December and, let's say, February, there wasn't that much going on because it's a kind of a dead period, like January generally is. But what we did have were some free speech demos, almost like a very, I don't want to use the word retarded, maybe
rudimentary.
No, not in that sense. I mean, retarded in the French sense, like late, we were doing these kind of free speech demos and these kind of turf wars, let's say, with Antifa on the street, occurred many times this year before and during COVID-19. It's been an ongoing thing. So I think it was January or February, basically the first thing in Ireland that happened that I can note.
So what, just to go back, what was the impetus behind those free speech demos at that time?
That's a good point, actually. Yeah. I had a video I made on that and it got taken down, but it was the slow boiling introduction of hate speech laws in Ireland, right? Nothing unique, nothing fascinating really to say about that, because it's happening across every Western country. It's part of the whole program, but it's happening here now. So we have to kind of, it's almost boring because England has it. And as I'm following UK media and American media, it's already done in England. It is anyway. So to be having this conversation afresh at home is kind of almost jading, but yeah, they're basically for years, they've been talking about it. A bill is being introduced. It's being put through la la la, this kind of parliamentary politics. I don't really care to understand. Point is it's being pushed and introduced gradually. as it happens right now, it's again, I don't know the language of parliament or whatever, politics, bills and all of that stuff. But right now it's kind of in its final stages. It is being introduced now. We are at the point as we speak where it's on the cusp of being signed into law. Maybe it was signed into law. Irish people in the chat can let me know. Anyway, that was really being talked about for the first time this January. They were kind of bringing it up more and more. And we were protesting that, kind of to various shades of nationalists. And these were fairly big protests, I have to say. And it's an element of the scene in Ireland that I'm quite proud of, that proportional to our overall population, it's quite a big crowd we got. Again, I can't remember everything that clearly, but and there were like three or four different demos this year. We would have 500 people. I could be wrong. Maybe it was 1,000. Maybe it was a little bit less than that. Point is, it was a very substantial crowd. You know, you go there and there's a roar from the crowd and there's a thick crowd. And so we were doing that. And we would be met with the usual, obviously, Antifa resistance, we'll say. Interestingly enough, one of the videos I did that did get taken down was so many tangents I could do here, but it got taken down, this video that made the point that the Antifa that showed up to oppose us, they were connected to a list of NGOs funded by the Irish state, right? And this wasn't very complicated or difficult for me, but I just decided to look at those NGOs, look into their funding structure, some private funding, some state funding, etc. And what I did was isolate, let's say they might make money from public fundraisers. I didn't count that because that's legitimate money for a charity. Fair enough. I took state funding and billionaire philanthropy funding. So the Roundtree Foundation, the Soros Foundation, whatever, that and state funding is what I count as regime money. And I calculated all that from each NGO and then did a sum total. And there was something like 30 million. So there was, let's say, 500 of us or something. And then there were 500 Antifa, something like that. That entire rally against us cost 30 million in state funding. It was unbelievable. And we were protesting. So think about that. The state are introducing hate speech laws. Private citizenry who are not being paid, such as myself and others, are coming out to use our rights that we apparently have to oppose that. And then the state put out a 30 million euro, kind of, don't want to say paramilitary, but kind of like a street thug group to oppose us. I just thought that was incredible. But that said, the violence that would be, we would get receive violence each time. I think we controlled it pretty well, which is a lesson learned, let's say, from the Charlottesvilles and all of that, or whatever. We would try to be like, we in advance, we would have cameras pointing in every direction, like phone cameras, and make sure to have people ready to start tweeting about everything that happened straight away and push everything back, the narrative. And we were generally pretty successful. We've been pretty good at that. I take some pride in doing that myself, but, or having a big role in that. But that happened like three times this year, basically. So that was like the first thing that happened, the one that happened in February, or occurred in February. And that was going strong. There was a really strong feel in Ireland that, you know what, we're getting big numbers on the street and no other country is doing this. Like, you know, Burgerland, Cook Island, whatever, you know, we could be very proud of ourselves. We're doing something uniquely better than everybody else, it seems. I don't want British and American people to get upset. I was being sarcastic there, lads. Relax. Yeah, I was kind of happy with that. And then COVID-19 happened and kind of changed everything, which I suppose brings us to March, doesn't it? If we're doing chronology, COVID-19 happens.
Yes, yeah. It was. I think the talk of it started publicly in January. That was when they started talking about, you know, the bat soup stuff and all that. And it gradually, you were expecting it, or I was expecting it to just go away. Unknown story, but then it remained, and then it gradually got bigger, and then in March, I think it was the 23rd of March when the UK lockdown began. So yeah. Yes,
It was quite an interesting thing. And you know what? I had to deconstruct my brain and build it back together again to figure out what was even real at the time. It was a big epistemological kind of revision and partial going insane at the time, because all the way back to, as far as I can remember, December or January, myself and some nationalist colleagues, let's say, right, people you chat to, chat groups, all that, we thought we were really smart because we had seen some of these videos from China, etc. We're really smart. It's like the Twitter meme where, you know, the guy is in the party and he's like, they don't know that I have a like small YouTube channel, you know, or whatever. It's like, we're kind of all saying, all these normie idiots and mainstream media don't know that there is this pandemic brewing in the East and it's going to come here and it's going to disrupt the global order and blah, blah, blah. And we're going to take advantage of that as radicals and kind of disenchanted outsiders. That was kind of where we were going with it in an Irish context. And we're good. That's just going to be our narrative. And it was so strange because up until I think something like two weeks, whatever, before we had lockdown, our government, and by extension our media, state kind of media, like regime media, were all in lockstep saying that lockdown, and they would do it like this, they would go, lockdown is a conspiracy theory peddled by cranks and fake news peddlers on WhatsApp. And we joked about it at the time. We were like, oh, these dangerous WhatsApp groups, you know, they kept saying, don't, because it was normies, like normie working class people who were on like, you know, WhatsApp and Facebook groups, uncontrolled kind of space. They like journalists and stuff were giving out about that, saying there are these rumors about lockdown. And what was, and we were going, no, there is going to be lockdown. We know the truth. And what was so strange is that 2 weeks later, there was a lockdown. The lockdown happened. And there's never been any review of that. People saying, how strange was that? Like that, it flipped. And then I remember myself kind of saying, maybe the state needs
to. You know, I hate to say it, but it's like that bit in 1984 where suddenly the enemy switches from Eurasia to East Asia. And the enemy has always been East Asia. I'm sorry to invoke such a big cliche, but I've just got to do it.
Well, the switcheroo was so disorienting because I was happy to put pressure on, it sounds a bit grandiose or whatever, but put pressure on the state, right, in a tiny, tiny way as a dissident kind of voice or voices. And it's almost like an entry route because as a nationalist, there's a certain amount of desperation you have. You know, you're banging on the door all the time. You're against such big forces. Normies are people are generally apathetic and understandably living their own lives. And so when something like this comes along, maybe you think you can Trojan horse your way into it a little bit, you know? And I you know, that's understandable. I don't kind of regret that too much. It's something you kind of have to work out. And then it didn't take long for the state to completely jump on it, as if it had been their plan all along. And suddenly we're kind of going, wait, this lockdown is kind of ridiculous. And, you know, so it's a complete switch around. I would have people now where I would want to go to a supermarket and not wear my mask. And I would say the mask is a kind of a way of oppressing and humiliating you a little bit. And it doesn't really do anything. And the numbers, sorry for YouTube, by the way, I'm impersonating someone else. I didn't say that. But you know, I would say you could give the spiel. You could say the numbers aren't actually as big a deal as you might think, all of that. You don't need to do these things. And the person would be like, no, cases are up. And I find myself in the strange position of saying, I was saying this in January. I was saying everything you're saying in January. And you were saying that I was, you know, I and people like me were mental. And yes. Now you're doing it. And it feels so strange and weird to be have flipped.
I mean, it brings the NPC thing into reality, doesn't it? They've received the new firmware update, and now they're just enacting the new program, and that's it. It's like it's alarming how true that meme has turned out to be.
Well, it is, and like, let's say, I was thinking about this. Like, in terms of the vaccine, right? I won't say anything breaking terms of service and all that, but just speaking generally, if I were to say, and I haven't crunched the numbers on this. I have a general feeling on it. I know some broad numbers and I know where I stand, right? But let's say I were to go to a NPC and who is excited to get the vaccine, and say, you know, the vaccine comes with a non-zero risk, as you know, all do, of course, right? Now you have to weigh that against your risk of COVID-19. Obviously, at present, you think that it's a true, real, and present danger for you as a healthy 30-year-old person. Do you know the numbers? And they would say, they would probably say, I don't, but I know it's bad and I have to get the vaccine. And if you were to go further and say, well, what if I were to give you a breakdown of the numbers that said all of this? Like what set of numbers could I give to you that would make you feel relaxed that you don't need to wear a mask anymore, you don't need to get a vaccine, and you're all good? They would probably say, in effect, I have no interest in that and I do not want to hear it. And nothing. They would say, there's no data set, there's no information, I'm not interested.
I think their attitude would be, Garode, do you really think that you know better than the mainstream media? Are you really telling me that you know something all these journalists and experts don't know? Is that really likely, Garode? That's the kind of thing that I would expect to hear if I said that.
Yeah. So that was to get back to the chronology kind of thing. And actually, it all ties in. But as far as I know, your last guest on this year's Millennial is going to be Dave Cullen, Computing Forever.
Yes.
That's going to be good. I'm definitely going to be watching that. I recommend everyone else does too. He might talk to you more about this. But I and I hope he doesn't, if he's watching, I hope he doesn't mind or anything. But like, I would chat to him the odd time. So we either chat by I'm just watching his videos, or we just kind of talk. Either way, there's a kind of an intellectual, shall we say, soul searching going on, where I was pro lockdown and I even made one of those videos where I was hectoring someone on the street and it went viral. I admit it, I did it, right? I feel bad, but like, that's how disorienting it is for me. And I'll get back to like Dave Cullen, how it relates to that, but I did all of that. So that's why I'm saying, if I spoke to a normie now who's telling me that we need to wear a mask and I'm wrong for being skeptical, I'm like, I'm literally the Karen, you know, you worship. I did that. I've been and done that. And so surely that should earn me the right to kind of start to question it. But I was doing all that, saying the government aren't doing enough, this is our chance, whatever.
Yeah, but was your line at the time that the government care more about the economy than about human lives?
Yeah.
Right.
And every possible angle you could come at it from, close the borders, for example, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's why when I look back, I don't go, oh, I'm such an idiot. I my instincts were so wrong, because I look back and I go, in hindsight, I may have been kind of wrong, but my instinct, like, that's an easy way to look at it. At the time, arguably, if you were to like kind of do it over again and over again and over again, you might make the same decision in a sort of way. Like, it would seem that way every time. But so that's the angle I was taking. And there's so much to it. Like, I was thinking, first off, it's happening anyway. At this point, the wheels are in motion. We might as well, this is our chance to say, close the borders, la, la, la. Also the conspiracy theorists, the people who think there are laser beams underground and pedo tunnels and all of this stuff. I was kind of slightly annoyed with that, you know, and felt like it was a bit of an issue. So I took my line and I kind of went with it. Interestingly, Dave, Computing Forever, he is a rational person. He's a very reasonable, very intelligent person. He's willing to explore alternative ideas, but he's not a kook, right? And he, for a moment, went along, not necessarily with me, but kind of on the similar line. He made a very good video, very well produced, very succinct, all that, as he does, talking about how like conspiracy theorists could end up making people sick, you know, by spreading false news, don't wear a mask and all of that. And, you know, I was intrigued by his kind of, he was soul searching a lot, and it caused me to kind of do the same. So where other Irish people, I'm very parochial, by the way, I only talk about Irish people, but that's the way it is. Keith Woods as well is another one. You know him obviously, but he was kind of on the other side. And then there were various other players, other international people. And I was trying to like judge it, you know, and think, what is true here? What's the best approach? Anyway, back to Dave. Dave does a U-turn and he does a mea culpa straight away and says, I was wrong. This looks dodgy, whatever. And so I remember kind of trying to gauge everything from, again, I'm keeping things Irish here. You have Dave, you have Dolores Cahill, who is she's like got a massive resume of medical expertise. She's an Irish kind of politician. She's one of our guys. And I'm trying to judge it. And I kind of stuck with it for a while, the COVID being what it was, maybe about a month. And then we started doing anti-COVID lockdown demos. So it's all very fickle, I have to admit, to some extent. But facts change on the ground and you run with them, you know?
Ah, of course. And so I suppose it's worth trying to characterize your two positions. So in the first place, you were thinking the government aren't doing enough because they don't want economic damage. They care more about the economy than about people. But I can see the evidence coming from China of people being welded into their apartments, people dropping dead, that kind of stuff. So, and so to get that nailed down, do you now think, and I guess we've got to be careful what we say, but are you now skeptical of that evidence that was coming out of China in January, February, March?
Very much so. Like, of course. And the theories, like, I am, yes. The short answer is yes. At one point, there was a guy who was, I don't know if you remember him, it was translated into English subtitle, I think. Obviously a Chinese guy, he's stuck in an apartment somewhere and he's apparently an investigative journalist of some sort, like a roving, kind of like a Chinese, well, Tim Pool. he's like, I have multiple sources, you know, and all of this. And he's saying that the Chinese government don't care and la la la. And looking back in it, just these videos were coming out from this guy regularly. That doesn't happen from China, I'm afraid. And that should have been possibly a red flag, a red dragon.
Good one.
But yeah, thanks. Almost as good as your line with Philosophicat, Paleocon.
Oh, God. Yeah.
I enjoy that, I have to say.
But, I was proud of it at the time. Yeah. All right.
I slightly laughed, I have to say. But so... Yeah, the Chinese stuff was kind of bullshit in some way. Even from the start, while I was doing the whole close the borders thing, I was still entertaining, like in part of my mind, I was saying, for all I know, the Western world, or maybe the broader world, has run its course in a certain economic sense, debt, I don't know, you name it. And they've decided to wind things down in a controlled demolition through this vaccine, or not vaccine, pandemic. Like I was saying, I don't know, maybe that's true, but look, there's so many things that could be true and I don't know. I don't have a microscope. I can't look at I don't know. So I just have to pick.
So err on the side of caution.
Yeah. And you have to kind of run with something. And I suppose some of the people who were skeptical from day one, I was kind of saying, like, I was trying to say, you know, I get it. I get all of these possibilities, but I was asking questions like, for example, I was saying, though you may be skeptical, would you acknowledge that a pandemic in principle can happen, just a natural one? And they would say, well, yes. And I would go, then why couldn't one happen, you know, and stuff like that. And of course, those questions, like as much as I've ended up agreeing with those people, but at the same time, they never were able to answer them. They never were able to like satisfactorily answer that. And yet they still ended up being right. So obviously their instinct, or maybe their past experience, maybe they're older, maybe they're wiser. They erred on another side, a different side maybe, and they just ended up being correct. And maybe that is based on a sort of instinctual empiricism, if that isn't too much of a contradiction. Like you've absorbed vibes, shall we?
Yeah. Yeah, perhaps. Or maybe they were just following what the media was telling them at the time, that there wasn't much to worry about.
Yeah, so and at that point, they were in lockstep with the mainstream media. But so it's all switching around constantly. But the what was the other thing that kind of, that, let's say, tricked me or had me running along the line I was running with at the time? That I was asking the skeptics of COVID-19, the people who thought this isn't a big deal, it's all lies, you know, the people who take that approach. It's kind of confusing. People at the time who were saying this is all the globalists are trying to make us afraid through this virus. I was saying, well, no, there is really a virus probably, and it's a big deal, whatever. And my question for them at the time, as well as like the China videos, I was saying Bergamo in Italy have had a high amount of deaths. And what I would do, just like with climate change or any big issue that you can't possibly fully understand, so you have to pick a kind of heuristic and use that as your kind of focal point or something, I would say Bergamo have had a lot of deaths. And then all I did was, I can't research everything about this virus, but what I can do is look at Bergamo deaths and say, because people would say, no, it's a sampling bias. People die of flu and now they're just counting it as that or whatever. So and it was difficult because of the Italian language and I would have to get help. Shit, my battery is low. I may have to plug this in a sec, but I forgot that. Sorry. But I would say, okay, no, actually X amount of people died compared to last year and the year before and the year before. And it's not just higher, but it's like twice as high or something like that, overall deaths. And I would ask the skeptics to explain that. And they would say, they would have all sorts of other data sets, but I would go, I just have one singular piece of heuristic that if you can pass that one for me, then I'll run with it. And as far as I know, that one, and again, I agree with skeptics now, but at the same time, that was what kind of fastened me to my worldview at the time, was that the Bergamo deaths were up, and when I asked people to explain it, they would say that the obituaries were fake. And I was kind of going, I was soul searching, trying to say, well, how can we have a conversation about what is real and what isn't real? And it's just a case study in the, you know, cringe as it might be, like you said, the Orwellian thing, where sometimes it's just impossible to know and you don't know what's real and what isn't. And like, to repeat, it's impossible to kind of know, and you just have to decide what you think is true. It's kind of scary in a way, actually.
It is for independent thinkers, but most people, I honestly think, just go along with, and it's not, I'm not even saying this to puff myself up or to condemn them. I don't enjoy saying this. I think it's just a fact of human nature. Most people just believe what the mainstream media tells them. And that is their heuristic. I guess we'll wait for Garaud to plug this in. But yeah, so
I'm listening.
Right, yeah. So that's their kind of their marker. That's their stability. It comes, well, what are the authorities telling us? So I guess my question to you now would be, if you're now skeptical of those videos that came out of China at the start that had you on the wrong footing, why do you think that China was misleading the rest of the world with those videos and stuff?
I have absolutely no idea. I mean, one could argue, we're back to, it's almost like playing some kind of fantasy world game or something where there's a million possibilities and you can pick any one and run with it. And that opens up a whole new world. And you go, but on what basis do I know? And if I don't know, then why should I even think about it? Because there are so many alternatives that, you know, it sounds kind of neurotic, I understand. But, you know, so to like answer your question like a normal person, let's say, why would China have done that? Potentially a imperialist, you know, trick, effectively, to weaken the rest of the world. I mean, I would think about that. I would think, what if they spread this pandemic that they engineered and then they have a vaccine for it that they kind of secretly administer to their own population and then just let it run rampant in the rest of the world, insofar as it even is a real virus, let's say. And then beyond that, just spread lots of propaganda to bolster it and, you know, pay off media. I don't know, who knows, but something along those lines is, you know, possible to entertain. I suppose. What do you think?
I don't know. My only theory would be that they didn't even know at the time how dangerous it was. So those propaganda videos might have been designed to propagandize their own population into just going along with, we don't know what this is, but we're going to tell you that it's fucking dangerous so that you are scared and you'll just do what we tell you to do. So it's to maximize their own control of their own population. But then those videos escaped into the Western world. And some people would have wanted that, like, would have, you know, that would be like manna from heaven. Oh, there's this secret threat coming from China, like the camp that you were in at that time. And and our authorities would have tried to play it down. I think initially that was what they wanted to do. Our authorities wanted to play it down because they weren't prepared for this. It wasn't part of their plan. It was inconvenient. But then a switch occurred when they thought, okay, we can actually use this. This is the crisis that we need.
You think the globalist, at least the Western globalist order, are able to think on their feet that fast, as in they're able to...
Well, the short answer is yes. Because if you've got people in every media institution, in the governments, who are, you know, basically the governments are now just puppet governments, they're full of idiot politicians who just do what they're told. Why couldn't you do this? Especially if you've got you hold the purse strings with the World Economic Forum and so on, then why couldn't you do this?
Yeah, I'm willing to entertain that, but at the same time, I'm willing to, like, again, it's the duality. One side of my mind could say, yeah, that could very well be true. And the other side of my mind says, that sounds ridiculous and yeah, whatever. And I'm it's kind of 50-50. I don't know. You know?
Yeah, I'm maintaining an open mind as well. It could well be that the governments of the West have been acting in good faith all this time. And at this point, it's obvious that the virus is not as dangerous as they thought it was back at the start, but it's too late to change course. They don't want to admit that they were wrong, or they're still playing it safe just in case. That's all possible.
Yeah. But that's the thing. I find myself now, I would have fully agreed with that. And now, and I know that's not your stated committed position, you're just entertaining ideas, but you know, I now find myself having come full circle where I think, no, things can't just be dealt with on the fly like that by these techno-capitalist orders that are highly sophisticated. I mean, you know, Stalin, five-year plans and all that. These regimes of the past, you know, did plan, like, try at least attempt to plan long-term. I feel like our technology is too sophisticated to not be able to, like, it's like that Keith Woods video, if you've seen it, on the anti-fragility of the regime. And I find it terrifying, to be honest, that, you know, as we're typing away online and trying to be dissidents and trying to be really clever, the machine, so to speak, is constantly absorbing data and kind of information and crunching it up and spitting it out in ways that we couldn't even possibly imagine. And it's being done at a international, global, perhaps, level that is actually mapping a path for the people. Like, it's absorbing the potential for every type of populist uprising and this and that, and economic up and down, and building in kind of stabilizer wheels to keep it all on course. And some of those stabilizer wheels could indeed be something like a pandemic, or some kind of mass event to reset matters. Like, I don't have hard information. And even if I did, what is that information? Where did I get it from? Who knows? You can take your pick. Just, it's all gut. It has to be at this point. And it's a real, that's why I mentioned epistemology a while ago. It really screws your brain up because you are kind of going, how do I know? What is it to know? Especially things at such a macro broad level. What are you to do? But instinctually, gut wise, then I do feel like that's incredibly possible that the regime en masse, or the big regime, is able to chart the destiny of the West now in a way that we couldn't scarcely keep up with or even understand. It's kind of scary.
Look, it's just a matter, surely, of sending signals. Right, just transmit this message now. And then that instruction goes from a team of maybe 20 people, maybe fewer than that, down to a team of 100 people, down to a team of 1,000 people, to 10,000, to 100,000. And then you've got every media outlet in the West. I mean, I don't really see why that is an unlikely or implausible scenario. If you've secured control over all of these different outlets over the course of many decades, then why wouldn't you have that power? And why would you not be prepared to use that power? I mean, I don't see it as something fantastical or unlikely or implausible. It just seems, what is power for if not to eventually use it?
Yeah, yeah. I do think about that too, whether you're talking about replacement, I don't know if you're allowed to say that, but or reset, all of these words we now have. You know, an average person could say, do you really think they're all plotting and this and that, and that they, or that there is even a they? And if there is a they, that they, for whatever reason, have nefarious goals, goals that are at odds or conflict with our goals.
Well, I don't think that they think it's nefarious. They probably think it's great. But they, why wouldn't there be a they? There's a they at the top of every corporation, at the top of every organization, at the top of every government. Why wouldn't there be a they at the top of international bodies? Yeah. We know that there is. And so it's not some kind of weird, wacko conspiracy theory. It's just an observation of that the world does work. Everything works in hierarchical ways. So, of course, there is a top level, believe it or not.
But people, you'd be amazed that people are kind of find it hard to internalize that reality. What the way I always think about it is, or try to describe it to someone or argue the point, is to say, like, look, you know, do you really think, like, look back at 16th century Poland or whatever was happening then, or some kind of dynasty in Japan or China. Historically, do you think there was some kind of overruling class that were kind of separate to the population and kind of, to some extent, kind of enslaved to the population for their own resource extraction? And they would say, well, I don't know all the history of that era or that place, but I mean, yeah, probably.
Yeah, if it involves
so, humans. So if your instinct, so like, what's so different about now? Why is now so different? And it's just, I think it's just a kind of myopia people have.
I think it's that people don't want to think such big thoughts because they feel like they, oh, I'm probably venturing into the realms of fantasy if I go that extreme, that outlandish. But no, you're not. I mean, imagine seeing an organization like a corporation and thinking, that must just all be happening by accident. It's not that there's a command structure. It's not that there are people overseeing it. It's not that there are people planning it out beforehand and in advance. No, it's just all just accident. Come on. So what's the difference then with the public? The public are ultimately a mass of people who can be directed with messages, hints, instructions. I just don't understand why it's a big step to take to go from, let's say, a corporation to the world at large. The only thing is an illusion that each nation is very independent and would do what the World Economic Forum told it to do. Really?
Well, that was a question I had, along with, let's say, to some extent, the China videos, more so the Bergamo thing. And lastly, my question at the time for skeptics was, what about Iran and Russia and places like that? Like, why is Iran going along with this, the international pariah? It seems to be going along with the plot. And I was kind of sarcastic about it because I'm like, you know, but I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question even still. I don't know. Oh. So that's that question. It's to some extent, it's kind of tiring, even for the most, you know,
but also irrelevant. I mean, China might well have whatever reasons for doing that back in the first quarter of the year. They are now, as far as I can tell, they're now back in normality.
They're raving.
Meantime, the West has gone on this program, on this line, and it's not stopping. In fact, they're upping the ante now. We're in tier four in the southeast of England. No Christmas. It's going to be shit. It's because a new, more virulent strain. So they're upping the ante. They're not letting up. No, I think that that's a decision that's been made, and they're not going to admit anything that we overreacted or whatever. This is a program, and I just don't see that as unlikely. In the end, we've been talking about the encroaching police state, the increasingly globalized world, the surveillance technology that's always increasing, the anthropological, sociological studies that are always looking for more ways to nudge people, to influence people's behavior at a micro level and a macro level. What did you think all of this was leading to, if not to exactly what we're seeing now? That's what I would ask someone who was skeptical about, and or who called this some kind of conspiracy theory. They talk about it openly, so it's not it's something that's wacko or outlandish.
Yeah, see, there are also reasons why people go along with it. I think first, I've been dwelling on it a little bit, like perhaps in a society that is so, let's say, atheistic or a beliefy. That's not a very good word, is it? That just doesn't have a nucleus, a thing to believe in, any kind of, as Jonathan Bowden said, I think, deep privatization and de-democratized and all of these kind of words.
Peter Mandelson, just a quick intervention. Peter Mandelson famously said, I think he said something like, the democratic experiment has failed. We are now living in the post-democratic era. Words to that effect. I mean, that's like 10 or 15 years ago. Again, what did people think was on the cards?
Yeah.
What did people think all of this was leading to? When politicians are openly saying things like that.
Yeah, and like, so in a situation where people do feel de-democratized, i.e. you say to someone, you know, we're being replaced, it's not good for housing, healthcare, la la la, you give them a basic thing, it's got the perfect rhetoric, it's reasonable, you're not too pushy, and the facts are what they are, and they say, okay, those are what they are, but I mean, what's the point in trying to do anything? Like, you know, it's, in fact, it's bothersome that you would try to do it. You may be right, but it's not even a question of that. Just, and that's a sad thing when you interact with people and they speak like that to you. You go, what happened to the romanticism? Where's that gone? And in that environment, when people are missing that, they're missing nationalism, they're missing religion, everything else, there might be a certain sort of therapy people derive from. This is the big pandemic. This is our shared experience. This is our, it's something we all, you know, all of it, and all the propaganda.
This is our blitz moment. Yes. This is our moment to shine and to come together and fight for something together. Yeah, yeah.
It's something even to talk about. What, like, you meet someone in a bar or wherever, right? Like, it had gotten so, like, grim before the pandemic that what's one even to talk about besides, I mean, people don't even all watch the same sport anymore. It's like, and that's paltry enough as it is. Like, whereas now it's all about the lockdown and this and that. And did you hear about what tier we're on and all this, like, nomenclature that keeps being introduced week in, week out, and people, it flows off of people's tongues as if they've had that word their whole life, which bothers me greatly when I hear that. The new word, what's the or not? What the la 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 la, this stuff, as if they knew it all along. But it's like, you just heard that on the news last week. Shut up. Something about that. And I just think there is some kind of societal psychology going on that in a sort of way lends people to it. There's a lot of people who are against it, a lot of working class people, a lot of people who are affected in certain jobs, a lot of jobs people aren't so affected by it and benefit from it. And so I think people can go along with it in some kind of strange vacuum that is the contemporary West.
Yeah, I mean, it does appeal to, you know, people. It's famously said, people love a scapegoat. People love someone to hate. You know, that's the thing that's often said. Well, people also love struggle. They love, there's a certain part of the human psyche that loves the idea of hardship and loves the idea of a difficult thing, but there'll be an end to it. We'll get through this. We've just got it all band together. They love that as well. They also, they might love moaning about the hardship, but they also love the hardship. You know, so this stuff can all be controlled. Again, it just takes sufficient resources and interconnectedness.
And algorithms.
And money.
Yeah. Like, there's also, like, I'm not afraid to admit there personally, and maybe for a lot of other people, perhaps there is an element of people that, people who either they were working and now they're working from home, or they were working and now they're not, but they're getting enough to get by. Hopefully some people aren't, and I recognize those people. But for the former category, there might be a lot of people, because society is so weird. It lacks, like, you know, the, I hate to be like revoking to trad stereotypes, but, you know, back in the day in every country, you would go to church on Sunday, you would go to a kind of a dance on Wednesday or this or that, or like, you know, you would be expected to be somewhere. You couldn't just say, no, I'm going to stay home and be a hermit. You know, you couldn't do that. Whereas now you kind of can, and people are kind of want to, because of maybe screens and various stimuli. People kind of want to do that. And I say me personally, because I feel that myself. There's a certain amount of me that's a little bit of a hermit that doesn't want to socialize, actually, that would like to stay cozy, stay home, and just kind of like close this bubble in around myself and stay inside of it and be comfortable. And there's an extent to which the pandemic afforded people a legitimate opportunity to justify that. And I feel like that's maybe a factor as well. Certainly was a little bit for me, which wore off after a while, of course.
Yeah, and of course, you've also got to think of the children. These ones who are being trained with social distancing at, you know, the age of five at school, they're at primary school, and that's their new normal. So what are they going to be like as when they're adults? You know, when they've grown up being told, don't hug granny. She's this bundle of bacteria and viruses. God knows what she'll do to you. God knows what you'll do to her. It's just not worth the risk. What's their attitude going to be to socializing? Yeah, this is going to have all sorts of, I was going to say, unforeseen effects. Who knows whether they're unforeseen or not. Maybe they're completely foreseen. But it's going to have all sorts of bizarre effects on people psychologically, and these effects will probably take decades to manifest, I think, in these kids. I just think it's so perverse and disturbing to see, you know, these photos in the news of kids at primary school that they've got to be 2 meters apart and all that. It just seems so different from what we had at that age. But and I think, yes, so if you and I, Even our generation, have this tendency towards introversion and not socializing. God knows what it'll be like for them when they grow up. But again, it seems to be that's something that I think benefits those in power. I mean, I should say, I actually do believe in hierarchy. You know, and that's what I said back at the start of my channel, 2014. I'm not against a power structure. I'm not against an elite. I think because people are sheep. You know, that's you know, if you don't realize that at the end of this year, then you're completely blind. People do need to be led and directed. I'm just not sure whether I trust the likes of Bill Gates, George Soros, Jeff Bezos, and all the rest of it. I don't see any reason whatsoever to trust them, because I think that they are people who probably have utter contempt for the rest of humanity. That's the way it seems to me.
Yeah, I agree. Like I have like two sets of beliefs on that. In one breath, I kind of think, actually, if the Western world, let's say for all of my life and a few decades before, had been given a democratic say, for example, in something like immigration, they would have picked the right thing by themselves. So in that sense, in some senses, democracy can work. If only democracy were truly practiced, I think it could actually work well. In another sense, it is also true, maybe simultaneously, that in general, people en masse are sheep, and it is what it is. And there's
a disparaging word. Yeah, it's a disparaging word to use, and I shouldn't have used that. You could say people are followers. Exactly as you say, it's not something to be bemoaned, and it's not something to be continually shocked at, but it is something that must be accepted. If you're going to talk about people, anthropology, and how society works. One of the first most essential things to internalize and accept is that people want hierarchy. People want a consensus. People want social norms. People want to be told what to do and what to think and what to believe and what to say. And again, if that has been made very, very obvious by the events of this year, I would say. It's not something that's bad, but it means that the independent thinkers among the populace have to accept they are the outliers. They are the weirdos. It's a fact of life.
People want a hierarchy. In a sense, I want a hierarchy, right? And I don't necessarily want to be at the top of it. Like, I think many people in our circles have said this before, that if we had a benign elite, even a bit, you know, a little bit greedy, a little bit whatever, but generally benign and identifying with you in some way, I would love to kick back and stop, you know, caring about, like, I would like to just care about minute things in my life and just kind of, but it's hard not to care when things are so wrong and you feel so kind of principled on things. I can't walk away. And that's something we could get into as well, the question of personal involvement in this stuff and the cost of it. And
that would be an interesting talk, but let's keep this stream on the events of this year. What I would say is, just to echo what you were just saying, I think when you see an image of, for me, probably the most perverse thing is Drag Queen Story Hour, where the drag queen is not just a normal drag queen, but it's even more weird than that. It's like a demon
devil
drag queen surrounded by wee kids. And when that is what's approved of by our elite, I do not trust our elite. I cannot believe for a second that they have people's best interests at heart.
I'm glad you say that. I don't know if I'm cutting you off there, but, you know, you were speaking to Hugh on The Offensive in your first stream, I think, and I was listening to that the next day after you did it live. And you raised a point that I've thought about myself and agreed with. And you said that globalism must be given, the devil, so to speak, must be given its due in a certain way. I think I'm characterizing you correctly, that to some extent it works. And if people go along with it, then to some extent, maybe that's what people want in a sort of way. And I know that's not your committed, tattooed opinion, but it's just something you were thinking. I've thought about that too, and thought it's important for us not to delude ourselves and to acknowledge that fact by acknowledging the inevitability of a certain amount of globalism or globalization and the technology and even some of the social mores that go along with it, everything, even to some extent, maybe a certain amount of migration, all of that. You need to give it its due to some extent and then draw that line. But, you know, I feel it's important to do that, but also to draw that line and then distinguish everything beyond that line, which is some of the stuff you just said, because
is doesn't mean ought. Just because it is this way doesn't mean that this is the right thing.
But like, you know, for example, you mentioned like people living, you know, in lovely rural cottages, you know, across the land being trad and all of this, like if some of our circles kind of go on with that thing and say that's the world we should have, a trad world of cottages and, you know, 20 babies and everything natural and so, and that's cool, that's a good thing, but we need to be realistic and acknowledge the inevitability of a certain amount of it. But the way I think it's, as much as that is important, it's equally important then to hold on to simultaneously the faults and the inherent problems that globalism brings with it. And I think that's a nice, sane, sober, rational place to be. And the problems to me are things like, very obvious things, like the inability to replace oneself, right? That's an obvious one. I need not unpack that. Everybody gets that. But it's worth reminding oneself that that is an insane problem. That's a big problem. That's not a small problem. It's a fatal problem, right? And even the solutions that they have of immigration are bound to kind of unravel at some point in some way, perhaps you could argue that. You go back to demon transgender story hour, obviously every mom and dad, normal and even non-parents, recoils at that, and yet they insist upon it. It is by no means a structurally sound or positive or good thing. Globalism is dead on arrival, I think, in terms of our, in terms of how we should accept it. As in, sorry, I'll rephrase. In terms of our perspective in whether we should rebel against it or not, the answer is, without any doubt, we should rebel aggressively against it. And we have to. And those two things are simultaneously true. But just that kind of, you know, the black pill that can set in, it's also a clear pill of globalism being what it is. You have to remember the righteous indignation is based on reality, very much so.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, any person, any man who fought in the past to change the world did so because he first accepted the way the world was and understood, at least partly, the systems in place that made the world that way, so that he could then fight those things. But that, you know, he, by recognizing the systems, he didn't necessarily approve of them at all. In fact, it was very much the opposite. So yeah, recognizing that this globalism does work in some sense does not mean that I therefore think it's a good thing and that this is the only way it should be and so on. I do have an increasingly nuanced take on all of this. As I was alluding to in that stream with On the Offensive, and I didn't go into it in much depth, and I won't go into it here in much depth because this is about you. But I do think that we should be careful. Well, it's like the trad thing. I've got nothing against that. I don't disapprove of it. I just think that we should be careful in advocating things that are unrealistic and unfeasible in this age, because you know we are all products of this, of modernity, and the nationalism as well, nationalism versus globalism. I actually think that Spencer was correct when he said, that's Richard Spencer, not Frank Spencer or something like that, when he said that it's going to be globalism. The only question is whether it's their globalism or our version of globalism. And I think that is correct. Yeah. That's what I would say, because individual nations, and again, you can see that this year has proven it, individual nations are not strong enough to forge completely their own path in the world. I'm thinking of the Sweden example, which did defy, for reasons still unknown to me, it did defy the order to go into lockdown, which I think was an order. But nonetheless, clearly, there is. I think that nations probably aren't powerful enough in and of themselves at this point to stand independently or completely independently.
No, it's just, I know full well that, you know, in some kind of like LARPy imaginary world, if I lead a populist revolution in Ireland, right, and my first order of business is to ban Starbucks, so that individual families and couples and stuff can open their own small coffee shops. The coffee would actually be cheaper if, I have a whole spiel on that, but like there's no argument for Starbucks. Someday sit down and have a think about it. There's none. And yet my first order of business is to ban Starbucks for the total greater good. No downside, only upsides. I'm getting Gaddafi'd 2 weeks later.
Yeah. Just start your own coffee shop.
So that kind of is what it is, you know.
Yeah, that's a more pragmatic reality that you would have to confront. And I'm not saying you shouldn't confront it. I'm just saying this is something that you would have to be aware of, that there are immensely powerful forces that have to be borne in mind, because they will oppose, and clearly do, to the point of shutting down absolutely everything that you rely on, including your ability to breathe, in order to oppose you and stop you from opposing it. So this is the reality. And I think part of the dissident movement in general, part of what it has to do now is understand the full scope of what it's up against. And again, there are many things that I could say about this that I have been thinking about over the last year or so. I think that it was almost too easy for us it definitely was too easy for us in 2016. And I think that we had the idea that, well, we'll always have our YouTube channels, right? They wouldn't do that. They wouldn't take that away from us. They wouldn't take Twitter away from us. Of course they will. But they'll do much worse than that. So we have to be really brutal about the reality that we're facing here. And that's not a black pill. I'm not trying to demoralize anyone. I'm just saying, let's not delude ourselves with, you know, with comfy ideas that this is going to be in any way easy.
It would be lovely if, you know, everyone who started in 2016 at this point could be a, you know, five times the YouTube star you were in 2017, payment platforms running below, super chats flying. Not that anybody's greedy about it, but hey, you're making a good living while abiding by your principles and fighting a good cause. You know, and all of the friends you made along the way, isn't that fantastic? That's not the case anymore, nor are, you know, purity spirals and stuff like that, like the kind of pure nationalism of 2016, 2017. I think that not has to be abandoned by any means, but has to be integrated into something bigger. What I've noticed in Ireland a lot is that there's a kind of a meeting of different people here. And I only, you know, again, I'm a little bit parochial, you know, so I talk about my own place. That's what I know. You have people now who are the old nationalists, the people who HBD, immigration, all that stuff, other questions as well, all stuff like that. And you have them, but now you have these kind of old hippies, basically, and some to some extent conspiracy theorists, then kind of slightly politically agnostic working class people, you all sorts of people who can kind of come together, and it can be problematic and can be toxic. These, it can kind of ruin your message if you're associated with the wrong people. But, you know, I can't say everything. I can't talk about internal stuff, meetups and this and that that happen in Ireland. But what I can say is there is a massive or a large group of people who are kind of like happy to be bedfellows. For example, with me, I am like a declared, you know, anti-immigrationist. You know, they call you an ist. I'm not going to describe myself as that now, but that thing. And they're happy to, it might not quite be their thing, but they will stand next to me and they will have me proudly next to them and stuff. There is this kind of broader incohate movement of people that are kind of not the journalists. They're not the tech companies and they're not the on the inside. And I think it's really important in some way as we go forward to kind of like be very open to all that stuff personally. And it's just a pragmatic political Machiavellian thing. But
again, I completely agree. And I would say that yet again, we should look at how our enemies succeeded in the first place. And, you know, if you look in the 60s and 70s, they didn't go around looking for reasons not to work with each other. They went around very much the opposite. And that's how they built coalitions, and that's how they got things done, and that's how we're now, well, now we've got Drag Queen Story Hour, because they achieved that because of their willingness to work with people that they didn't agree with 99% on, or even 50% on. It didn't matter because they had this much more, frankly, intelligent approach, socially intelligent approach, which was, how do we get this done easily, quickly, and as successfully as possible? And it doesn't even need to be 100%. We only need 5%, because then we can build from that. Yeah, again, our side is full of people who are just not thinking realistically.
I slightly not push back against that, but I slightly, in that kind of analysis, that I slightly would disagree with, in that, you know, the whole Marxist march through the institutions and all of that Frankfurt School stuff, the idea of us replicating that to some extent is relevant. But would you agree with me that from the start, from the 60s or whenever we want to say it began, the money power was kind of with them?
Oh yeah. I mean, I don't want to go too much into this because it's a different topic altogether. But yeah, of course. I mean, there was, you know, the hippie movement, even the punk movement, and probably everything that followed that. Yes, money. Yeah, yeah,
Therefore, our attempt to replicate that or to kind of compare against that would be different. We are facing a different thing in that we will not have hidden money and universities and all that kind of stuff coming or bigging up our sales or whatever. We're going to not have that. We're going to be peasants holding pitchforks, metaphorically, figuratively speaking. And that's all we have. And I don't know what to do with that against the algorithm, but that is what it is. And there are people, not everyone is about the immigration thing necessarily, but there is going to be a broader and broader movement of people. I think last night, Robin Riley, you were talking to her and she was talking about the mum community and all of this. And I see all of these people. I could get onto this in a while. I moved out of Dublin in the middle of the pandemic, change of lifestyle, all that. I might get into it later, but however long we're going to be here. But, you know, I see Irish people who fled from Dublin in every direction for financial reasons because they don't want to be in some kind of multicultural neighborhood. All these reasons. Because they don't want to be trapped in a box, because they want to have a nice environment. Every reason. And they're all fleeing out and they kind of know why. You have the people who are, I've been talking about this lately, people who talk about the best of Irish cheese, Irish sheep for wool, and all of this kind of stuff. And yet you go talk about Irish labor, you know, and you're not allowed to talk about that. But they're at least hypocritical as they are, they have an essence of some sort of weird cheese nationalism. And there is something about that. There's something about the kind of Swipple, you've talked about them before. And then the kind of hippie people who have like a van and they have like a makeshift thing in the back and they drive around and they only eat natural food and all of these people are, there's some sort of essence in a large number, a large swathe of people that I think as time goes on, they can only become bedfellows with us. And we all kind of arrive at the same thing where we do not want to be slaves to techno-capital. We do not want to be poisoned by toxic foods, the birth control pill, you name it, all of these toxic influences in our lives. We want to some extent to be, it might not be trad, TM trad, but to some extent we want to be, oh, we don't have time to get into it, but like you get
what we're talking about. Yeah, we want something other than the pod and plugged into McDonald's and Pepsi and all that. Yeah, of course. I don't think many people could object to that, really, to have it wanting something better than that. Okay, well, shall we return to the chronology and rattle through? I think we've done a very thorough and, I mean, I guess there's so much more that we could have said, but nonetheless, it was a very good, meaty discussion of the whole COVID thing and globalism and all that. Hmm. Let's rattle through the rest of the chronology.
Okay, and I'll do it quickly because this is in a way like kind of self-indulgent because I have a list and I'm going, this happened and this happened. A lot of it relates to me from my perspective. So I'll do it anyway and then, you know, you can wrap up whenever you want. In April, there was the Keelings thing, which happened in England too. Keelings is a fruit manufacturer. They make, or not manufacturer, they grow fruit, berries and all this stuff. They sell in Tesco or wherever. The berry pickers from Romania and these Eastern countries. You had this too in Britain. I know you did. We had that and nationalists in Ireland exploited it to death. And it was so funny because it was a national media war, the media defending Keelings, us against Keelings, saying that it's slave labor for these people to be brought in. We are in the middle of what we're being told is a global pandemic, and yet you have to bring people in from Bulgaria to pick literal raspberries, right?
I remember this. So, yes, again, it's one of those things where you think globalism is obviously perverse, mm-hmm. because otherwise, or at least the globalism that we have now is obviously perverse. Why on earth would you be doing this? It's just, it doesn't make any sense. If there are unemployed Irish people in large numbers, why would you be literally flying a different workforce in from another part of the world to this small country to supplant those Irish? It's just incredible.
Bizarre. It's bizarre. And the, again, this it comes back to the question of like, you give globalism its due to a point and then you criticize it to death, right? Justifiably. Like, you know, for example, the smarmy like bug journalists would say, oh, well, are you going to go pick the strawberries or whatever? You know, these people are doing the jobs the Irish won't. Lala. You've heard, we've all heard this stuff. And my retort obviously would be, well, again, just as predictably, well, I'm not going to do it for like less than minimum wage, living in some prefab, working for 12 hours a day and like, you know, like abuse left, right and center and just horrible conditions. No, I'm not doing that. Yeah, I'm not going to do that. But if you tell me, hey, we need to get these off the vine before they rot or whatever. I don't know, is it a vine or not, but it's something. But we're in desperate conditions and, you know, we need to make some kind of profit this year. Not much will go to top management, but we need to get the thing done. So, okay, we'll make a bit of money at the top, but we'll also pay you, you know, 15 euro an hour or whatever, right? What, as much as we possibly can to just get you to do the work. And what we'll do is we'll give you nice shifts and we'll give you breaks and we will roll out the red carpet like desperados because we have to. And I'm going, well, yes, obviously that's the employment scenario that we want as people. Of course, as human beings. And they, of course, then it's, you know, mute and block, right? But what was interesting about that, I remember, is that like we had, you know, I like these minor interactions with powerful figures, influential figures. Conor McGregor jumped on board that thing and he started saying, oh, we need to close the borders. And, you know, it's not like we're best buds, all of us and Conor McGregor, but, you know, you get these little nods and winks from people like that. And that was kind of fun. So that was something that happened. You asked for a chronology. I can just keep going. You know?
That's fine. Keep going. Yeah, it's quite enjoyable.
Next, we had in June. So this is personal to me. We had a situation. It's personal to me. It's relevant to Ireland, but it's relevant internationally too, because this story is replicated everywhere, right? We had a boy by the name of Adam Noonan in Carrigaline in County Cork, down south where I'm from myself. He was stabbed on video by like three black lads were standing around, stabbed him. And the line that sticks with me to this day, because you can see the stabbing, the video went around. It's horrible. Like it's disgusting seeing someone be stabbed, literally. The line that stuck with me was one of the lads doing the stabbing, or the guy taking the video, sorry, likely laughing, you know how it goes. He said, look at the blood, fam. Look at the blood, fam, which is I know it's grim, but it's also, it's kind of, even in the way he said it, it's kind of London-y. There is this kind of black population in Ireland that kind of, they want to be the London blacks. They want to say things like ends and fam and stuff like that, right? And they probably half their cousins are over there or whatever, right? And so they have to settle for being in little old Cork town and whatever, but they're living the same life. Not all, some, whatever. So they did this and he ended up in hospital, you know, for a few days. And I don't know what his situation is now. I think he made a decent recovery. What followed from this was really interesting because when that happened, the video emerged at about 11:30, 12:30 midnight. And myself and some nationalist colleagues, shall we say, decided, okay, we're going to do an all-nighter here, lads. Put the coffee on and open up your second computer monitor. I want to expose this as a journalist, and so do others. This is an important story. And so we did that. And the next day, all of the journalists in Ireland, the official regime journalists, woke up to a shit show because it had gone everywhere. It had gone viral in an Irish context. It had gone around America a bit. And they were like, what's happened? Because they had just gotten out of bed. Now, they may be paid by the regime handsomely by the hundreds, but they have to sleep. And they did, and we didn't. And they woke up and it was too late. They could not really get that back in the bottle. The chat can correct me. Irish people might be in the chat. I can't quite remember. I think they shut down Reddit Ireland permanently, or else they introduced a permanent thing of shutting it down at night to this day. I'm not sure. Someone remind me. But we changed the face of our Ireland forever with that, because a lot of the message was spread on Reddit. That's how badly they reacted to it. What happened from there, stop me if I'm going on, was that myself and another nationalist troubadour in Ireland by the name of Mick O'Keefe, him and I set up a GoFundMe for Adam. We didn't say we weren't explicitly, he was attacked by these blacks, or we weren't doing that too much, but we were, to some extent, it was implicit. This was kind of a racial attack. It was as evidenced by us as George Floyd was, you know. For example, the cop in America did not say, I'm kneeling on this black man because he's black. It was just implicit and kind of understood by people who saw it that from their perspective, this is clearly a kind of implicitly racial violence. And it was equally obvious, the stabbing. So we ran with it and we just said, we're not doing a racing. We just want to raise money for Adam in his time of need. This is, you know, he's going to need some money. His family could do with a relief. And we raised €6,500 basically in a night, which is, you know, a lot. And it was, we were keeping close track of it. It was making money really quickly. It made six and it was just like, it's going to be 12 when we check next. It's going up. And the regime got into gear to get that taken down, basically. All of these various organizations, like International Strategic Dialogue, something like that. There's a thing called Moonshot CVE there. Countering Violent Extremism, all these groups coordinated with journalists and everything to get this taken down. They got GoFundMe to take it down. We appealed to GoFundMe to get it back up, but they had sufficiently scared the family. I'd never talked to the family, but it was obvious that the family had been scared by this because, for example, in Cork, the local radio station, 96 FM, that normies, let's say, listen to, they had done a piece that morning that these far-right extremists are trying to make this out to be a racist attack or a black attack, let's say. And these far-right extremists, known extremists, all this kind of stuff, without quite mentioning our names. And of course, that would have gotten back to the family. There were probably people who contacted the family directly. So then GoFundMe said, we will put it back up if you get the subject of the fundraiser to give a thumbs up, i.e. the boy's family, the boy's parents. And we tried to get in contact with him and we were hitting brick walls everywhere because they had been frightened clearly by this thing. So eventually it hit its deadline, the GoFundMe, and it had to go down. In the meantime, the GoFundMe shutdown had gone viral to some extent in America. So it was a much bigger story than it ever was when it began. I was on, bizarrely enough, Michelle Malkin, right, who would have seen that one coming, talking about it, talking to her and everything. If it had gone back up, if we were able to just get the thumbs up from his family, it would have made much more than 6,000. It would have made 60, 40, 50, 60,000, who knows. And how good would that have been? That could set that boy up for life, potentially. You know, imagine getting that in the prime of your life. You know, you could save that money, mortgage, everything. A holiday for his family. And it was all the work of these weird, mysterious anti-extremism groups, these NGOs in Ireland who were coming out saying that we're scamming, we're far right, everything. They did that with that. Those, there are sensible reasons because we're far right. But I know that they're sitting there.
We're depriving a boy. Yeah, but you shouldn't accept the label far right, though, because that's you do not strike me as some kind of far right maniac, as some extremist. And I think when you accept that, it's a mistake.
I aggressively refute it, but I call him. It was Keith Woods reminded me of this. He linked. He came on with me one night with this article that stressed that we're actually centrists. Not just as a rhetorical trick. If you actually like break it down, you go, I'm actually just realistically a normal person centrist. And I maintain that strongly. But the difficulty is that I don't have the money to sue media organizations and NGOs. And that is what it is, right? I can't sue.
I mean, and just to interject, it's perfectly fine when if it's a black victim and a white, stabber, killer, whatever, there would be absolutely no problem with GoFundMe having this thing up on their thing, on their website. No NGOs would be attacking it as a racist or far left, communist, Marxist thing, trying to make use out of this boy's misfortune. Absolutely nothing. So that should be a sign. I mean, I want the likes of Hope Not Hate to answer this question. Why would you attack this for being a far right trick when you would not say the same about if the roles were reversed, if the races were reversed? You know, that's
they would just laugh.
Yeah, of course. I know that they don't need to answer. They would just laugh. I know. But I just want to point out that what they're doing is not just hypocritical. It simply doesn't make sense according to the paradigm that they themselves propound.
Yeah. And like, not only that, but the parents of this boy and this boy himself, not because, of course, I reject the labels, but the labels were stuck on by people who have a kind of media and stuff. Well, those same people who were saying, no, Adams family, we just want to tell you that it's these far-right extremists, had, and this is speculation, had his family said, no, this isn't a political thing, this is just some people raise money, we'll happily accept, thank you. I think the same people, the same NGOs, would have put that all over the newspapers, family accepts money from far-right extremists. And then there would be a target over the heads, and they would happily put that target there, make no mistake. Yeah.
Whereas if the races were reversed, those same NGOs would be donating, and corporations would be donating money to the GoFundMe.
Yeah. So it just highlighted, you know, the fact that Irish people in this country are fair game, basically. You know, you cannot raise money, you cannot be racist to an Irish person. Or indeed an English or American. There was an interesting wrinkle to this as well, is that some of the more, the kind of, as Morgott describes them, the, what are they called? I'm thinking the dove, the, what is it? The person who pretends not to know anything.
The newborn.
Something like that.
The egg.
Yeah, I can't remember. It's something like that. But the hatchling. But there were these more hatchling types who would say, oh, what's racist about it? He didn't sign a document saying it was a racist attack before he attacked the boy and all of that. But
unbelievable. Yeah. Well, did the policeman who, with George Floyd, did he sign I'm a racist killer? No, he didn't.
It's just kind of understood to some extent. But it gets even better than that, because either the previous week, it was either a few days, like a couple of days before or a couple of days after, there was an attack in a different city and county, a place called Limerick, where there was, and it was another video came out, where a boy was kicked on the ground, kicked, viciously kicked in the face on the ground, right? I'm doing a kicking motion here for those who don't know. But this boy was kicked, and I did the journalism, I suppose, basically. I sleuthed around Limerick kind of circles and found people who knew the boy and got the story and got screenshots, and I documented it all. What had happened was that this boy, who had an Irish boy, had posted a white square on his Instagram while people were posting black squares. And he wasn't like some kind of far right, you know, I reject the label, blah, blah. But he wasn't some kind of political person or ideological person. He was just a kid being like, I'm going to do the different thing, to be kind of like, this is jackassed here, like, you know, kind of like just
edgelord.
Yeah, edgelording. Oblivious. And these black people in Limerick were like, oh, fam ends, that's bad, racist. And they set up this witch hunt, and they were like, you're going to pay, you're going to suffer all of this. Completely unremarked upon, obviously, by any media, before, during, or after. And then he said to the guys, the black people, basically, he said to the black people, he said, okay, look, I posted it because I was trying to be funny, and I didn't mean to, I didn't think I was upsetting anyone. I offended you. So, and like a good noble Irish lad, right? He says, sorry, right? I'll take it down, and I'll meet you, and I'll come shake your hand, right? Put it there, right? Which is, look, I don't think he should have to do that, but in spirit, it's a good thing. I respect that attitude. So he meets up with him, and they mob him. They drag him to the ground, and they kick him in the face, beat him up. He had to go to hospital. And
good deed goes unpunished.
I had all the evidence of the what went on before that attack, and even in the video, the black guy says, post in white squares, we've been slaves for 300 years, la la la. He does, in the Carrigaline thing, I'm lamenting that the black guys didn't literally say they were attacking him for racial reasons. Fair enough, we understood that one, but it's not explicit. Limerick was explicit. And I banged on the door of every journalist saying, will you condemn this racist attack? Are there any NGOs? This is an explicitly stated racist attack. It not only was racist, but it had the explicit and widespread endorsement of the attacker's own racial community. As in, it was widely endorsed before, during, and after by that person's own racial community. Whereas even if a white person attacks a black person these days, it's going to be one loon, right? One violent person. But this had universal approval from, so I'm going, hey, you're talking about hate crime, lads. I have a perfect example for you. It's all here. And those two exist in eternity now. Those two that happened in the same few days as a kind of a justification for everyone forever to reject any kind of hate crime or hate speech effort in the future. Not that anyone's going to listen to me, but it's there at least as sort of an evidence that can always be weaponized and weaponize everything we must. So that was that story.
Incredible. Yeah. Absolutely incredible. I mean, not in the sense that it's difficult. Like, it's surprising. It's not surprising, but it is amazing to see such an extreme example of the regime's hypocrisy and dishonesty. And, you know, as you say, you could analyze it. You know, the Irish were not allowed to vote on mass immigration. Then they were not allowed to complain about it. And then when one of them got stabbed, they were not allowed to have a GoFundMe about it. And on and on and on. You know, this is what globalist powers think of the Irish people. Just nothing.
Ah, yeah, they don't like us very much, or any natives. That kind of raises another question of birth citizenship that's currently being floored at the moment. There was a referendum in Ireland, just to speak to Ireland. That's all I'm good for here, right? There was a referendum done, I think, in 2004 in Ireland on birthright citizenship, because at the time, because of the Good Friday Agreement in the north, a loophole opened up, birthright citizenship became kind of legal accidentally, and 60% of all asylum applicants, female asylum applicants coming to Ireland, were pregnant on application. And it wasn't just nationalist activists, it was nurses and maternity wards and all sorts of normal institutions going, we can't do this, we just can't do this. So a referendum was floored, and it was, I think, the biggest majority, or at least one of the biggest in Irish history. I think it was 79% voted to rescind birthright citizenship. Now, this was 2004, so merely 16 years ago, and they're already talking about, we need to either have another referendum, prime the people to vote the right way, or find some way to just subvert it. So that's currently going on as well. So it's all, you know, all pistons are running at this moment. So I'm back to the chronology.
23 minutes left, then my next guest is due, so we should try to rattle through.
Yeah, okay. It's funny how we ended up doing it this way. So many more rallies, anti-lockdown ones. There was one we had with thousands and thousands of people, nationalist activists plus anti-vax people, all of these people kind of united in a way. There was one in London too, at Trafalgar Square, I'm sure you saw. My videos were taken down of those, etc. But that's kind of an interesting thing, a positive development, that this kind of unity of people. And I think other countries, England specifically, I won't name any names, but I think that's something nationalists in England should maybe do more of. And far be it for me to give advice, look, but I can take advice and I can give it, you know, and insofar as I would give it, I think that's worth pursuing more.
A visible public display of opposition to whatever is going on is valuable, for sure.
And whatever you must do to increase those numbers and have that big number, even if everybody doesn't quite agree on everything, but they can stand together, that's good. Another interesting thing in Ireland has been like this banning of sharing of intimate images of women, let's say. It's all over the media constantly. It's OnlyFans thoughts, basically. This is happening everywhere, but this is our version of it. There's this big scandal that there was a revenge porn leak where thousands of images were shared. Actually, it just turned out those images were OnlyFans pictures and stuff like that. Stuff people just put out themselves, thoughts, basically. And it was used as a justification to kind of ban the sharing of intimate images. So now thoughts are able to do their thing without the potential of repercussions, without the internet turning around and kind of shaming the Mac. And it, you know, like, oh, you can put your naked pictures on the internet, but, you know, actions have consequences. The state are actually actively stepping in to say, we might just take those consequences off the table because we want our girls, you know.
The OnlyFans thing is so disturbing. I mean, that's the thing in itself. I know that there are some women who make huge amounts of money from it, and it's, but then there are all these guys going without girlfriends, going without wives, who'll never have families and all that. But they can donate money to an OnlyFans thought. You know, that is, it's just incredibly wrong. It's just wrong. Yeah.
It's, and it, like, if you, speaking of birth rate, like Ireland's birth rate fell 24% in the over 5 years. I think very recent 5 years, maybe the very last 5 years, or maybe starting from 2 years ago to the 5 years before that. But in a recent 5 year period, 24% in 5 years. That's what abortion and OnlyFans and all of that does. So, I mean, does feel a bit genocide-y, doesn't it? There's, I've been kind of done with my, I mean, that's basically the year. You have OnlyFans, you have immigration, you have anti-Irish racial violence, you have a pandemic. Yeah, it's all going crazy.
And the framework for it all is the globalist regime that has been imposed on Ireland, or has imposed itself on Ireland, the course of the last 20-30 years.
Yeah, it's debatable, but some kind of recent period. It's very it is very regime change esque. It's been very strong here, and
they're installing kind of democracy.
Yeah, it really is. So I don't know. I've so much stuff here. I over kind of like almost prepared, you know, that kind of way. But that's basically the year in essence for us. And we did a big long chat on globalism too, didn't we? I had a whole spiel on the end of history, but let's not go there.
We can do another stream on that.
Yeah, that'll be another one. It was all about the GDR and how the GDR were actually cool. I'll do a video of it myself. Don't worry about it.
All right.
Yeah.
Excellent. Okay, well, I guess we should just leave it at that then, unless there are any final words you want to add to this. I mean, I'm not really sure how to wrap this up. It's been a very interesting stream. I think and expect and hope that people have enjoyed it. I've definitely enjoyed it. Go on.
Well, it's that, to some extent, I'm just kind of, I moved to the countryside and my internet is really crap. And so I haven't really been streaming or making videos. So there's a bit of like, it's like vomiting out at this point with me. You know, it's kind of like you're sitting on like thoughts and ideas, and I do love to speak and I love making videos, and I just love streaming. Even if two people watch, I enjoy it. So you might say I like the sound of my own voice. I don't know, but I do enjoy the...
No, like, honestly, I'm the last person to criticize you for that.
Yeah, fair enough.
In my first year, in my first month, I did over 100 videos back in 2014, because there was all this stuff just bottled up for years and it all came pouring out. So, you know, I know what it's like, believe me.
Mine is like, so I'm kind of almost like, I'm like hopped up a little bit, but for me, it's just been a few months, but it's still coming out, you know. The reason I have bad internet, and I kind of want to describe this quickly, cut me off when you need to, is that I moved from the city to the countryside. And it's important, as we were talking about COVID-19, because COVID-19 actually worked out really well for me. That doesn't inform my political position, even though it's tempting, is that it ended up being the impetus for me leaving the city. I was facilitated to be able to do that, go to the countryside, lovely, beautiful. And as a consequence of that decision, all sorts of other fortuitous things fell into place for me, amazingly, right? And it's kind of lovely. It's brilliant. I'm loving it, right? That's not the case for everybody, I understand. But what it has kind of reminded me of is that I was sort of stuck. I don't want to go into the lifestyle coaching type of thing here, but one thing I want to say, as we're in millennial and, you know, it's a momentous, you know, part of the year for people, and people really spill out their ideas. My parting shot is that for nationalists who are watching this, there's, you know, and you talk about this a lot on your channel, many other guests have, personal life, personal growth and all of this. I have to emphasize that. It's a theme this year, but it's so true. And I've learned it for the first time. Being committed to the ideas and to the movement is important. And it's not a binary choice. You don't have to pick one or the other. But it's just what you have to do is not get lost in the battle, the struggle, the ideas. You have to build a life for yourself. Only this year has it dawned on me and become apparent to me that it's actually not that impossible. You can acknowledge that housing is difficult. We're in a bad situation. It's hard for people to have kids and all that. But that is no excuse for you to not say, okay, well, it being what it is, I'm still going to try to get a house. I'm going to try to have kids. I'm going to try to lead the good life. It will make us stronger activists. I felt bad. I'm not streaming as much. I don't have as much time. There are many years for me to come. I'm not going anywhere, but it's so important to build your own life. Our enemies will hate us all the more. And it makes you a stronger person. You know, that's all I will say on the life coaching type of thing. I won't say how or why people should do it. Everybody has different struggles, but just in terms of your direction, your attitude, you should try to build a life for yourself. It's important. I think you'll agree.
I definitely agree. And it's something that, again, has come home to me. I mean, I'm quite a bit older than you, but for various reasons, my development was delayed. And so I'm now coming to the same conclusions. I think I'm nearly 10 years older than you, actually.
I'm 20.
So I've reached the same conclusions myself now, that eventually you just have to, it's the best idea is just to grow up. You know, the best thing is to set yourself up with a nice permanent or at least long-term stable way of life, but that's for another stream. Just before you go, some other people, there's a guy who really wants you to talk. He's posted four messages about this. Can you bring up those it's an Irish word, I don't know how to pronounce it, SAORADH.
But that's actually, Sarah or Saru, actually, some people say it, but to me it's Sarah, and I think in Irish it's Sarah.
I bring them up. Zero goons at the November lockdown protest.
They're a kind of an offshoot. You've heard of the provisional, the new, the everything IRA, the different types of IRA. There's some kind of offshoot of that. They're kind of pathetic, but they're also dangerous. They did kill a journalist in Belfast a few months ago, or a while back, Lyra McKee. But they showed up as part of this NGO group to oppose us. They were violent. They attacked people with children, got all that on video and made, you know, hay with it. But they're just goons. They're pathetic. I actually have notes. It's another day. It's another time. But the whole North situation, the IRL, all of that. To the person who asked that question, I could go off on a huge thing about them, but I can't do that now. But they are, it's endlessly complicated, but there's an Antifa element to that kind of paramilitary Irish IRA stuff, let's say, broadly. There's also a nationalist history, which I'd love to talk about. It's complicated, but those people, but they are effectively criminal scumbags. I called them earlier in the year in a stream. I was just in my own stream. I said, they're just drug peddling, murdering scumbags. And I had a lot of people message me being like, hold on, easy tiger. So I don't know, slightly dangerous, but also kind of irrelevant and fuck them is what I would say. They're not nationalists. They are losers. They're anti-nationalist losers, basically.
All right. One final question. Isn't it, and this might be a good one to end with, isn't it impossible for the recovery of self-respect without mass civil disobedience against this beastly system?
It's worded strangely, but
yeah, it is. Isn't the recovery of self-respect impossible unless we have mass civil disobedience against the system?
Possibly. I mean, on a mass scale, self-respect. I have plenty of self-respect, and I'm not civil disobediencing with others. On a a mass populist level, civil disobedience. I don't know, really. Maybe. What do you think?
I think he means, how can there be self-respect if we go along with corruption? And I think that is true. I would agree with that. As for civil disobedience, it depends what you would mean by that. I don't really. I certainly wouldn't advise that anyone break the law. But if you mean rebellion, protest, that kind of thing, dissidents in general, then yes, I think for many people, that how could you respect yourself if you willingly go along with something that you think is corrupt and evil?
Yeah, and civil disobedience, you know, there are many revolutions, like, you know, in a time of universal deceit here in Mordor, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. At this point, eating a healthy food, treating yourself well, being good to yourself, it's a cringe thing to say, but trying to, like I say again, trying to get some property for yourself, getting a place to exist, trying to find a good woman or man, and aspire to have children and follow through on that, all of that. At this point, doing any of that is a revolutionary act, I really believe. So call that civil disobedience if you want. I think it is in this society.
Yeah.
Not what they want us doing.
Yeah, I would agree. But that's, again, that's not to advocate any kind of crime. We're just saying that what the lifestyles or options, the ideas that we're advocating are not what the system would have you do. It would have you in the pod, frankly, to invoke yet another cliche. All right, okay. And that is not something that's pleasant or life-affirming or healthy or nourishing, I don't think. I think that what they want for us is something very perverse.
Yeah, and I'll just one more thing is that leading that good life, there's something strange, not strange in a bad way, but about millennial this year that I found interesting is that people, I spoke to you last year, but there's some people you've had for several years. I think last night Robin was her third year and a few other people are on their third, fourth year, stuff like that. It's interesting because this is a vehicle to see people. You've talked about stunted millennials and stuff. That being what it is, whatever, seeing people come of age in a certain way, seeing people in the 2016 mode and now and stuff. And I count, not to be, you know, people will laugh at me, like do the friend meme, but I count you and many other people in the movement, people internationally, as friends. And it's nice to come of age in a certain way together and develop positively together. And some people who don't have faces out there and are anons and stuff, I know some of them privately as well. And for those who I don't, you're still kind of involved, not to make a cult out of it, but we should all try and attempt to thrive and watch each other as we go. And every millennial, it's a great thing to see. I found it very wholesome this year, to be honest, in a way. Wholesome millennial.
So, yeah. All right.
Anyway,
that's nice. It's nice to know that. Yeah. And I agree with you about what you've just said about community, because that is what this is. All right, excellent. Well, that's great. This has been a really nice one. I've enjoyed this immensely. Okay, so that was Garrod Murphy on Millennial 22. Not 22. What am I saying? Millennial 2020. Thank you for taking part, Garrod.
Thanks a lot for having me. See you.
All right. And I'll be back in about 10 or 15 minutes with Crypto for Nationalists, so that should be very interesting. In the meantime, thanks for watching. See you later.